This is the state of things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao, in for Frank Stacio. Picture this. A self-driving car hurtles toward a pedestrian and a dog. The car's brake lines are cut and the machine brain must decide, kill the human or the animal. What would you do? What if the dog were yours and the person were a stranger? Hal Herzog cracks open research papers to ponder these kinds of questions on his blog, Animals and Us. He explores the morality around pets in the age of cloning, artificial intelligence, and veganism. Hal is a professor of psychology at Western Carolina University, and he's also the author of Some We Love, Some We Hate, Some We Eat, Why It's So Hard to Think Straight About Animals. Hal joins us now from partner station Blue Ridge Public Radio in Asheville. Hal, welcome to the show.
Well, thanks for having me on.
Tell me about your cat, Tilly, and what she has taught you in particular about this term that you call the pet paradox.
Yeah, Tilly sort of exemplifies in some ways the pet paradox. And what the pet paradox is that the more we think of animals as people, that is to say, the more we think of them as creatures with a degree of autonomy, that they're decision-making sentient creatures, in some ways, the more morally problematic is our relationships with them. So, for example, with my cat Tilly, I feel like because she has this, I like to give her some autonomy, and including the autonomy to go outside. And she exhibits this autonomy by killing small, lovely little creatures, oftentimes like birds and small animals. And so I'm sort of faced with this moral dilemma. You know, should I make Tilly live inside the big cage called my house, or to... You know, where she sort of stares out and looks at the birds, you know, frustratingly looks at the birds flitting by all day? Or should I let her go out and be her true cat killer self? And, you know, to me, interestingly enough, you know, there's lots of ethical issues about animals, you know, eating meat, should we use them in research and stuff like that. But, you know, but for me, my relationship with Tilly is the most morally problematic relationship with an animal that I have.
Well, you are a researcher, so you've tried to look at this as objectively as possible, and you tried to compare the moral impact of Tilly as compared to other animals. Tell me about that. What did you learn about Tilly's impact?
Well, it's really hard to say. If you actually look at the impact that cats have on wildlife, it's really quite significant. Somewhere between, and there's some disagreement, 1 billion and 5 billion, you know, birds are killed each year by our love for cats and our need to have a pet in our life. You know, similarly, this is really exemplified, for example, by my friends that are vegetarians or vegans. And they don't eat meat, almost always for moral reasons, but yet they have, many of them live with cats, and their cats don't share their moral concerns about eating meat. In fact, cats are obligate carnivores. And so they have this fundamental moral dilemma about, you know, loving an animal that happens to be a killer.
So these problems that we think of as maybe heady and philosophical really come to the fore in recent research when we're talking about self-driving cars. And we actually have to program into these cars choices and real-time decisions, and we have to look at the value of one choice over another. So talk about the trolley problem as it relates to animals.
Let me explain the trolley problem first. The trolley problem is a sort of philosophical problem that's used by ethicists and psychologists to study moral decision-making. And the simplified form is this. There's a trolley going down a set of tracks, and there's, for some reason or other, three people standing on the tracks. In some cases, they're tied to the tracks. It really doesn't matter. And the trolley is headed for these people, and in one version, there's a lever that you could pull that would make the trolley go to another set of tracks where there's one person. And the question is, should you pull the lever? So, you know, should you make the utilitarian person to kill one person as opposed to three people? And most people say yes. This sort of problem is used to look at moral decision-making. And one of the most interesting current experiments using this, and it's still going on, and you can take it. If you're a listener, you can go to the MIT Media Lab website, and if you just Google moral machine experiment, it will pop up. And this is a game, essentially, where you have to decide what types of decisions should be programmed into self-driving cars faced with these sorts of decisions. So, for example, at a crosswalk, they have animals crossing the tracks. And interestingly enough, this game has been taken by over 40 million people now worldwide.
So what have we found out about how people react toward the animal versus person question?
What we find out is that worldwide, people overwhelmingly choose to sacrifice the animal to spare the person.
How about if the animal on the road is a subject's pet? I know that's not the particulars of the MIT study, but there have been other studies that have looked at that question.
Yes. So a group of researchers at University of Georgia made a slight change. And what they said, in this case, it was a runaway bus. And you could save one creature, and it would either be a person of different types of people or a dog. And so, for example, I think when it came to saving, saving a foreign stranger versus a dog, the vast majority of people, I think it was about 85%, said that they would save the foreign stranger over a dog. Well, then they ask another group of people, well, what if it was your dog? In that case, it changed quite a lot. In this case, 40% of people said that they would save their dog, even if it meant the life of a foreign stranger. And by the way, one of the most interesting differences was a sex difference. Women were much more likely, in all cases, were much more likely to save the animal than they were the person.
So I have a dog whose name is Oliver, and I was thinking about your research and about him last night and about this question of paradox and how my feelings toward what's okay for him differ so greatly from what's okay for a stray dog on the street. How do we come to this classification of, you know, who is a pet, who I treat as my family member, and then who is a pest or an annoyance? Talk about the complexity of that.
Well, this complexity really plays out with dogs probably more than any other creature. And, you know, one thing you've got to realize is that our view of dogs, the relationship we have with dogs in the lives of Americans, is different than it is in other parts of the world. For example, a number of parts of the world, dogs are seen as members, as items on the menu. In other parts of the world, dogs are seen as disgusting, and you would never have them, in your house or sleeping in your bed. In the United States, in the last 30 years, what's happened is we've had this phenomenon that the pet industry calls the humanization of pets. And we are increasingly thinking of members as real family members, and we're really increasingly thinking of them as people. In fact, the New York Times had a headline recently, and the headline was, "Dogs are people too." And there's interesting moral quandaries associated with that.
So are there any compelling arguments against pet ownership? I know that you have a pet yourself, so you may be slightly biased, but
I think there are some. I'm increasingly starting to wonder about the ethics of pet ownership, especially the more we recognize the idea that animals, you know, are creatures that have a sense of themselves. And, you know, for example, when we say that we consider pets as family members, but we don't really treat them as family members, for example, we would not cut the reproductive organs out of a human family member. You know, we would not make a human family member eat the same dreary, you know, dried food every day for the rest of his life. We would not let a human family member never go outside or rarely go outside without being tied to a leash. So on the one hand, we say that, you know, we love these creatures, and on the other hand, we do things that are not in their benefit. And, you know, best example probably is we would not intentionally breed human family members for deformities, which is what we do with some dogs.
Well, take me a little bit more into that, because I would say as the owner of a rescue dog, I can feel morally superior that I'm saving this animal that would have had a bad life, may have been euthanized in the shelter, versus someone who chooses to get a dog that has been carefully bred. I may, you know, feel better making that decision, but there's a lot of complexity there.
There is, and you actually exemplified what I'm talking about when you said that your dog was a rescue dog. And what I've found in recent years, you know, I've talked to hundreds of people about their dogs. I'll see people walking a dog on the street, and I'll walk up to them and say, "Hey, what kind of dog is that? You know, tell me about your dog." And you know, what they used to tell me is that, "Oh, you know, she's a purebred lab, or she's a purebred golden, or, you know, German short-haired pointer, whatever." Inevitably now, almost inevitably, over 90% of the time, people do exactly what you did. They say, "Oh, he's a rescue dog. You know, he came from an animal shelter. And so what we've seen in recent years is we've seen this shift in the types of dogs that we want to bring into our lives. And it used to be that most people wanted to bring purebred dogs into their lives. Nowadays, most people want to bring rescue dogs into their lives. So that we've seen this moralization of the idea of saving dogs. At the same time, dogs bred for deformities, for example, French bulldogs, are taking over labs. In fact, have taken over labs as being the most popular pet. They've taken over labs as being the most popular pet in Great Britain, and they're rapidly increasing to that level in the United States. And these are animals that have been bred for genetic deformities, and they suffer.
Okay, we're going to continue this conversation in a moment. We're talking with Hal Hertzog. He's professor of psychology at Western Carolina University. He writes the blog Animals and Us for Psychology Today. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Stay with us. This is The State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Anita Rao in for Frank Stachow. We're talking about pets and ethics today. Hal Hertzog is with us. He's a professor of psychology at Western Carolina University. He's also the author of Some We Love, Some We Hate, Some We Eat, Why It's So Hard to Think Straight About Animals. So you were getting a little bit into this question of selective dog breeding, and this is actually pretty recent in our history. Tell me about the history of this.
It's surprisingly recent. There's over 400 different dog breeds in the world right now. However, the vast majority of those breeds have only appeared within the last 150 to 200 years. And they really began in about 1830, 1850 with the rise of kennel clubs in Great Britain, which quickly spread to the United States. And now we've got this proliferation of highly inbred breeds that are just amazingly different in form. So we've got dogs that will max out at 200 pounds, and we have dog breeds that'll max out at 2 pounds. That's the difference between my weight and the weight of an African bull elephant. So dogs have become in 150 years the most variable mammal on the face of the earth.
So it raises this question of what's natural? Is it natural to be breeding dogs in this way? And I know that this was fodder for a heated discussion between you and your wife. Can you tell us briefly about that and where that ended up?
Well, let me talk about natural first, and we can talk about the heated discussion between me and my wife. We've actually did a study of what people consider natural in animals and unnatural, and that this isn't based in reality. It's based in what people perceive animals to be. And so we, for example, had people compare. We developed a little scale. I won't go into the details, but we had them compare, for example, the naturalness of a wolf compared to the naturalness of a purebred dog compared to the naturalness of a clone dog. And what we found out was that domestication, for example, people perceived a purebred dog as being about 70% as natural as a wolf. On the other end, they perceived a clone dog as being about 30% as natural as a wolf. So cloning, genetic engineering, makes a dog in terms of the way we evaluate it mentally way less natural. And that had to do, and that gets to the argument that my wife and I had about cloning dogs.
And Barbara Streisand spending $50,000 to clone her dogs.
Yes. And so the question that I asked my wife about was, hey, Mary Jean, do you think Barbara Streisand should have the right to clone her dogs? And my wife said no. And I said, what's the reason for that? It's her money, she has this pet dog that she's worried about is going to die on her. Why shouldn't she be able to clone it and get the puppies? And my wife said, well, it's just unnatural. And so this is a very powerful, what's called a moral heuristic amongst psychologists that study morality, what's natural and what's unnatural.
All right, Hal, I only have 30 seconds left, but you may have a new creature en route to you who could solve all of your moral dilemmas about dog ownership. Tell us about the robot dog that's on its way to you.
Yeah, Sony is sending me a robotic dog to play with for a couple of weeks. The robotic dog's name is Aibo, A-I-B-O, and supposed to arrive tomorrow, so I'm really excited about it. And Sony originally developed this robotic dog about 10 years ago, and it's expensive. It costs about $3,000. But it's you know, computer controlled, and apparently it's pretty amazing. It's so amazing that studies have shown you can take Aibo into, for example, a nursing home and let people in the nursing home play with it. And one study found that that was equally effective as playing with the therapy dog. So I'm excited about Aibo. To me, you know, I do have moral concerns about bringing real animals into our lives, especially the way that we're doing it. And, you know, to me, I've got hopes. I'm hoping I'm going to fall in love with Aibo. I think it's not going to happen, but I'm hoping.
Could save a lot of your problems. Hal Herzog is a professor of psychology at Western Carolina University. He writes the blog Animals and Us and authored the book Some We Love, Some We Hate, Some We Eat, Why It's So Hard to Think Straight About Animals. Hal, thanks so much.
Thank you.